It's Bungie Podcast time.
We're the Bungie Kids with plasma pistols glowing. It's our podcast show with Brian and friends
and Frankie.
Welcome to the Bungie Podcast.
Welcome back to the now with 100% less Scottish version of the Bungie Podcast. I'm Luke Smith. With me is Brian Gerard back from New York. And our special guest this week is Damian Isla. Brian?
Luke?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're back.
I'm back. I'm here. I tagged in and Frank's out. He's down in Australia with Lars Bakken at the moment doing some more promotional stuff.
It was hard, but we did it without you.
I heard. It was a good show.
Some people called it the greatest show ever.
Well, they haven't heard this show yet, so we'll see.
Setting the bar high.
Yeah, well, we keep bringing in awesome guest speakers. I think that's what's carrying the show.
Yeah, it's not you, I, or Frank at all.
Yeah,
it's
I don't think so.
It's the extras.
So that's a lot of pressure, guys.
Yeah, no, yeah.
No. You got to step
no pressure,
it up.
No pressure, Damian, but, you know, to date, Dan Miller was lauded as an awesome guest, but I'm pretty confident that
I can do better than
you
Dan
can blow
Miller.
A Dan out of water.
You think you can eclipse Steve Miller?
Yeah.
Okay.
You got it. So, Damian, what is it that you do? Why are you here today to talk to us and the kids?
So, I am the AI lead on Halo 3. And apparently you guys wanted to hear about AI and all the cool stuff we're doing for AI for the game. And I am super pumped to talk about it.
AI is artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence, yes.
So what does it take? Before we get into some of the specifics of the game, what's it take to, what tools are you using when you're devising AI, and how is someone going to get involved with that? We get a lot of questions. You guys don't in design and dev, but Sketch, Frank and I always hear questions from people like, hey, I want to work at Bungie someday too. How do I get a job being a designer? I want to program AI. Like, what's sort of the base to begin at?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of information out there on AI techniques, both sort of classical AI techniques, sort of academic techniques, and also just what we use in the games industry. And when people ask me about, like, well, how do I become an AI programmer? Like, I always tell them, like, make demos. Like, that's awesome for us to you know, you could put anything on a resume and it's always impressive. But, you know, we've had, like, PhDs from Carnegie Mellon come in and do horribly on the interviews. Whereas we've had other guys come in who, you know, have said, hey, I don't have any credentials, but, like, I put together this just, like, kick-ass little demo, which just shows, like, you know, guys running around the world and not only behaving intelligently, but also behaving in a way that sort of supports gameplay. Like, that's the fundamental thing to know as an AI programmer, is that, like, ultimately what you're doing is supporting gameplay. You're supporting the designers. Which is incidentally why, you know, academic AI is so far removed, in fact, from what we do, because, you know, they prefer black boxes and abstract worlds and symbolic, messing around and not, like, sort of the embodied, like, I'm walking around with a physical body doing smart stuff.
How long have you been with Bungie?
I've been 5.5 years now. I just had my, you know, knighting ceremony.
Nice. Did you get like a gold T-shirt or something for 5 years?
you get this sort of a crystal monolith little thing from Microsoft, which is, you know, in a box somewhere in my basement. And then you get a couple of T-shirts with your character on it, and you get knighted in a very moving, very ominous ceremony in front of the whole studio.
So you were pretty much right in the early beginnings of Halo 2 is when you came.
Exactly.
Out.
Yeah.
What were you doing prior to coming into Bungie?
I was in grad school. Okay. Actually, yeah, doing AI stuff in grad school, again with animated characters.
So Halo 2 was your first shipping game that you had the privilege of working on.
That's right.
Well, that's not a bad jumping off point.
Absolutely.
So you're one for one.
I mean, even Halo 1 way back in the day was it's still lauded for a lot of the AI in the game itself. So I mean, you had some big shoes obviously to come in, and you guys were able to push that even further. I think trying to remember way back when we were pushing Halo 2 and things like having AI be able to drive vehicles for you. We definitely didn't have that in Halo 1. I mean, there were several new advancements there.
That was one of my early victories, was the first time a Marine got into a Warthog and started driving around and killing the player. And
well,
was like, oh,
I mean,
fantastic.
Now it's like hyperactive. Like,
I'll drive right now. You get out to like switch weapons with a guy, and the guy's like, I'll drive.
So we were, like in Savo Highway, the big sort of grassy plain area where there's a lot of vehicle combat that happens. Got out on foot for a minute, turned around, the Marines hopped in the driver's seat, took the vehicle, and bolted without me. And it's
yeah, that's right.
That's not really a mission where you want to be stuck on foot, because it's like, you know, it's your real-time walking several kilometers.
And what you can't hear is them laughing as they drive off.
Yeah,
actually,
they just tore off. And eventually I was able to kind of commandeer them and kick them out. But I noticed that maybe it's just me, they seem really aggressive.
They're very eager. No, that's in fact, and we got feedback on that, and I believe we've toned that down at this point.
I thought
point,
it was kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. Yeah, yeah. They keep you on your toes.
I mean, just speaking of driving, I was mentioning that to you earlier. Some of the media events I've done where, you know, we have a wider range of participants. Some people are hardcore Halo fans and they know ins and outs. Some people have never played an FPS game at all. And it was kind of interesting on that mission to see some of the broad press didn't really feel comfortable driving, didn't really know if they wanted to do the chain gun. They would just hop in the passenger seat and just sit back and go along for the ride.
Enjoy the ride.
Right, yeah, right. And meanwhile, their AI companions are basically kicking ass and taking names.
You will last approximately 300 milliseconds on Legendary with that yeah. strategy, but
actually, yeah, my strategy for Legendary does involve the AI. I a Marine buddy on the back of my Mongoose. I give Luke credit for sort of showing me that little extra tip a while ago, but that saved me many a times.
Yeah. Those guys are super accurate, frighteningly so. You're like, how'd you? That's amazing. I have to watch the same film of that rocket.
And it's like now, not only are they doing like more complex behaviors, but you'll have like, you know, a half dozen or a dozen Marines at once, sort of interacting not only with the player and with the enemy, but also with each other. So,
I mean, that's actually, I think, one of the big differences between Halo 2 and Halo 3. I mean, apart from like really refining what we had for Halo 2 in a way that's really great to be able to do, like, we just have so many more guys now. And, I mean, more guys entails its own problems, you know, like more guys in a scene means, you know, more guys, you know, sort of bumping into each other when they're trying to go through a door or something like that. Yes, thank you.
That's the Arbiter.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, they make a little sound.
I mean, what has been some of the biggest challenges? I mean, just aside from scale and more guys, but like, obviously you guys have really pushed forward and you're able to do a lot more now. You've got the 360 behind you, and what's the challenges that come with that? I mean, how much can you guys do that you envision in your head? Can you really do to make these characters more realistic and more fun?
Well, you know, a lot of, this is not going to be a really exciting answer, but a lot of the times, the more complex our game worlds become, like the harder it is for AI to do even basic stuff. You know what I mean? So something like pathfinding is still something that we wrestle with all the time because, you know, our environments have become just like an order of magnitude more complicated and more geometry and all of this. So it's just like there's still so much work that goes into doing the basic stuff. And that being said, like, you know, we rely a lot on the designers, on the dialogue with the designers to decide what is appropriate for an AI to do in particular cases. You know, what are the characters' individual abilities? What are the tools they have available to them? I tend to think that the more an AI is able to do in a basic way, the more intelligent they sort of seem because they seem more flexible. And so, you know, adding equipment to the whole sandbox mix is, I think, a great step for us in terms of making AI look intelligent, because like all of a sudden there's like, oh, now he has like five different things he could possibly do when he's attacked instead of just, you know, three, or, you know, even just increasing that little range of action is.
And it's like immediately apparent. So it's like when I come over that crest and I've got my sniper rifle and I zoom in and I take a pot shot at a brute, I can almost like see it's going through his head, because maybe I'll knock his armor off and then he's going to throw a bubble shield down and just wait for me to close
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Yeah,
we had this little interesting standoff there, or, mm-hmm. or the time when you have like one brute throws down the shield, the other brute throws down the regenerator. So like they're all sort of, they just form this big wall of shields and healing. And
that's true.
Like,
yeah.
Come on. Or the chieftain, for example, that
like power draining you out of your warthog and fuel rod cannoning you.
That is, that's amazing. Yeah. That's happened to me quite a few times.
Some of the stuff I've seen this week playing the Epsilon and has been, brutes working in like deploying equipment in concert, where an encounter on Savo Highway that we call the garage brings a couple of phantoms in on legendary, and like baskets of brutes fly out, like just packs. And the jetpack brutes will flank you and flare you while other brutes are like power draining you, and it's all happening in this great concert where you're just wondering like, oh my god, how can I possibly survive that, and seeing that unfolding. And it doesn't, that's not how it happens every time. This is like, it's totally dynamic.
Yeah, it is absolutely dynamic. I mean, the brutes, like all our AI characters in a lot of ways, are just like this massive collection of rules. You know, it's just a massive collection of like, hey, one thing you consider to do when the player does this is to throw down a bubble shield. You know, when the player does this, you can consider doing this. And so
is it, I mean, and I'm not a programmer by any means, but is it really just like this massive string of like kind of like if then scenarios, where it's like, if I'm in this situation, I could do A, B, or C, and then if I do C from there, I could do D, E, or F, or what's the layman's
destroy the romance of the AI programmers' daily life. But no, I mean, like,
is there a way to boil it down and for non-tech people to understand?
You know,
how does that actually work? Because it honestly, still baffles me. I don't get it.
Absolutely. Like, honestly, like when you come right down to it, what you have is like, if then, you know, I mean, essentially what you have is like, in this situation, do this. In this other situation, do this. Now, what is really complicated about that is that you have about 5,000 of those little if-then rules. And so,
and they're all cascading, right?
And they're all cascading, and they're all like, you know, any particular time, you have about 100 things you could do. And so a lot of what the AI boils down to as a process is, what is the best thing for me to do at any particular time? You know, like, what, you know, I have to analyze the situation and try and decide, well, yeah, okay, there's these 50 things and these 50 other things. Now, let me first make a high-level decision and say, well, I'm going to consider only these 50 things. And then among those 50 things, maybe 10 things, and so on and so forth.
Meanwhile, all within like a millisecond in the middle of a battle.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's all transparent to the player.
It's all transparent to the player. And,
I mean, the brute's like, could you pause for a second?
That's right.
My buddies and I are talking this over real quick.
I'm only to option 500 out of 700.
I used to write some basic text adventures for the Commodore back in my IS class in junior high.
That's right.
I had some...
Sketch Zork.
Yeah, some similar scenarios.
Exactly.
You know, you can go east or west, and
there's a door in front of you.
So we've come a long way.
What would you like to do?
We've come a long way.
In some ways, it's humbling to consider how far we have not come. In a lot of ways, we're still dealing with the same.
What do you see as someone? Obviously, now that you've worked on these two games, and you're an avid gamer yourself. I mean, where do you see this field going in our industry? Is the sky the limit? I mean, you look at something like Spore, and there's a lot of these games that are really doing so much to try to recreate life on a box of circuitry. What gets you excited? Where do you think we're going to see this stuff pushing?
You know, in a lot of ways, it's interesting. I mean, you made a point five minutes ago, about how equipment is cool because it's really visible to the player. And so what we have to do when moving forward in game AI is like not just make them smarter, but make them visibly smarter. So as we make them smarter, we have to make sure that those smarts are sort of transparent and obvious to the player. And I think right now there's a lot of ways in which our AI are not smart. And I'm specifically talking about, in a lot of ways, the way they move. Animation has not fundamentally changed technologically in a long time, probably in 10 years. And there is just such a difference between, say, a little 5-minute demo reel that an animator might put together showing a character moving around the world and the sequence of animations that our characters actually play when playing a game. The latter, the in-game animation being far more sort of robotic and stuttery and sort of full of pops and interpolations. Like, we've done, I think, a fantastic job in Halo 3 with all this stuff, but it's still not quite of the smoothness and the amount of character that an animator can put together in a demo reel. And so there's just, it's such a hard problem, you know, because it's not just an animation problem, but it is an AI problem as well, because part of doing good sort of characterful animation is about showing intentions. And, you know, if I'm about to reach for this pen, I first draw back my hand and then reach for the pen to tell the viewer that I'm about to do something with my hand. And that sort of shows smarts. And figuring out some way at a very low level to let the AI show smarts on his body through his body stance and, you know, through how he chooses to move is huge, and still it's a field we still only just begun to investigate.
What is your professional opinion of, like, AI the movie? Are we going to
have...
That
is so funny that you should ask. It's so funny that you should ask that. For two reasons. First, that I watched it like 3 nights ago.
Oh, I thought you watch it like monthly, or is it
no, actually,
required viewing?
Yeah, it is required viewing, right?
Right. Are we going to see, in your just professional opinion, in your lifetime, do you expect to see some sort of near sentient program?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's no question. It's no question. And I mean the thing that's interesting about that movie, I actually really liked the movie. I'm probably one of the three people in the world who liked the movie. And like the ending. The really interesting thing is that I think that movie asks is, okay, there's like real intelligence and artificial intelligence, and really what's the difference? Like, that's the fundamental question of AI, is like, really, we're all just if-then-else statements, ultimately. We happen to be implemented in neurons, you know, instead of code. But we're still if-then-else statements.
Just blew my mind, man.
Whoa, dude, this is what I do all day.
Very philosophical episode of the Bungie Podcast this week.
I apologize. I apologize.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
It's correct.
It's gold. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
If she says no, then you say yes.
Yeah. You know, going back to Halo 3 for a second, we talked about this earlier. I was going to ask, has there been a time when sort of your own AI creation has done something that surprised you?
Has it turned on you?
has it turned on me?
Like, is there an example that you can share that wouldn't spoil anything too significant, that of a time that you were actually just amazed by your own work, or something crazy happened that you just didn't think was possible?
You know, I think I had an experience the other day on that same garage encounter, in fact, which I agree is an awesome encounter. It's epic in all kinds of ways. But no, I had a fantastic moment the other day where there's a swarm of birds coming around the corner. I start shooting one of them. He throws down a bubble shield, but I kill him before he manages to actually like hop inside it. And then I, thinking like, damn, I'm smart, I hop in his bubble shield. And of course, just as I get inside the bubble shield, I realize, oh, I really don't have that much ammo left, but at least I'm in the shield. But then the next brood comes around the corner, and the next brood is a brood chieftain with a fuel rod gun. And he turns around, you know, this big rocket launcher thing. And he turns around and he sees me. There's a very clear moment of acknowledgement in which our eyes lock. We say, I know you're there. He knows I'm there. And he just turns around and he knows I'm in the bubble shield. He knows he can't hurt me. So he just waits. And he just sits there and he waits for the bubble shield to go down. And I'm there. I'm looking at my watch. The clock is ticking. I know the shield's about to go down. I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? This guy's going to kill me. And so I'm like, okay, that's it. I ready my short range weapon. And I'm like, I'm charging out. And of course, the nanosecond that I show my nose outside the bubble shield, bam, he kills me. And I'm dead.
That
and
guy's
I was like,
a real jerk.
Oh my God. That was awesome.
The fuel rod cannon chieftains are like the secret hero of Halo 3's brutes, I think, because they're like, every time you see one, you cower in fear.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
Oh God, this guy is gonna. And with the changes that
even
we experienced
now, yesterday,
we were playing Legendary yesterday, yeah. And the trajectory of the fuel rod cannon was adjusted to make it more rocket-esque, where instead of like, you know, like, and it comes at you slowly, it's like rapid fire, huge pellets of destruction. Yeah.
Are there actual AI changes between like easy and legendary, for example, or is it not so much the AI as it is just like their health and their damage and things of that nature?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, actually there's really not. I mean,
It seems to me like on Heroic and Legendary that they seem more cunning, but it may just be that they're living longer and have more time to do stuff.
That is exactly right. Yeah, that is exactly correct. Like you spend so much more time in cover that they have a lot more time to move around and get to places. You know, we really don't change that much. You know, their vitality is larger. We do tweak some numbers like propensity to throw grenades, you know, rate of fire and this kind of thing. But not even that much, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's certainly not the fact that they're smarter in one or the other. It is the fact, as you're saying, that they live longer. They have more of an opportunity to sort of like display their full behavioral repertoire instead of.
You mentioned throw grenades, and that was like one of the first things we showed back in the Brute documentary was sort of that pack structure, and you had the chieftain or the commander who gives the throw grenade command, and then all the other guys step forward and. I've had that when that does happen, it actually it's pretty intense when you're on the receiving end. And, I also remember a long time ago when, I think it was you and maybe Paul Bertone were showing me some of the scripting for how the pack behavior stuff works. And, I don't know, is there anything you can talk about with that and maybe how that's changed? Cause did Halo 2 have any sort of notion of that? Was there sort of a hierarchy of how the characters relate to one another?
There was a very basic idea of, you know, a grunt having a quote-unquote leader character. So the grunts sort of knew that elites were, you know, were sort of their leader characters. And so there was a very basic way in which grunts would say, an elite just died. There are no other elites around me. I should panic and run away. Sort of the well-known sort of like run away and panic when your leader dies. And one of the things that, in fact, since you mentioned Paul, was actually really interested in pursuing with Halo 3 was to basically make that a real system, make it a sort of a more well-rounded part of the sandbox. So now, I mean, we've extended that whole thing to, you know, trying to get it so that, followers will take up certain positions relative to their leaders. Certain bodyguard characters will protect their leaders, by, you know, trying to pick a nearby point in front of them to stand at. And
yeah, I've noticed the chieftain just sort of sit back with, you know, they kind of just sit back there with their arms crossed, scowling, you know, just waiting, and meanwhile all their minions kind of charge out and take the brunt of the assault. It's like you know what's coming, though. He's just sort of waiting for you to get weakened down, and then that's about the time he suddenly makes himself invincible and comes charging at you with a giant hammer.
That's exactly it. And what's also cool about the whole leadership thing is that, as you say, like by making that again transparent to the player, like it means that now the player can make decisions about how to attack an encounter. He can be like, well, I'm gonna whittle down the followers and then deal with the leader at the end. And if the leader's a hammer chieftain, you know that. That's an intense, scary experience. Or you can be like, well, I'm going to try and take the leader out first with some kind of tactical strike, and that too causes the followers to behave differently. So you know, you sort of know how things are going to. Yeah, it's the sandbox. You know, you got a little toy and you know how to poke it, and that's the idea.
One of the other things that we showed way back in the Vidoc was the various types of brutes. I mean, we've been talking about the chieftain, and there's the commander class, and there's sort of the infantry classes. And without getting into too much detail, there are different sort of behavioral patterns based on where these brutes fall in the hierarchy, correct?
There is sort of a standard, I'm trying to remember how exactly we organize this. There's a standard hierarchy where we have like sort of normal brutes to brute sort of captains, I think we call them, to brute chieftains, who are the highest. So there's one hierarchy there. And then we also have another of sort of special sort of variants, which are sort of these spice variants that sort of don't quite fall into the hierarchy exactly. But guys like the jetpack brutes and, you know, some other guys fall into that category where they're just whatever. Yeah, they don't do the positioning part of the leadership-follower relationship so much, mostly because they're sort of this spice that's added onto an encounter when it's already there. That's the idea behind them. So, but yes, they behave very differently and they attack you in very different ways. And you know, you have to figure out how to deal with them.
Yeah. There's some pretty sneaky brutes in the second half of the game.
That's right.
Literally.
Have you gotten to that part yet? Or
no? Sketch, yeah, have you played that far? I mean, yeah. I know that, you know, during the day.
Uneasy, yeah.
It is
yeah.
a difficult game.
I use my all my debug cheats. I go deathless, and yeah.
You know who does that? It's Joe Staten is always playing with, like...
No, he said that's for story review purposes and pacing. Like, he's
but
not...
But then he'll sit and brag about what he's doing. Like, oh, I just one-shotted that thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you turned on the one-shot cheat. Oh, yeah. Okay. How about
that? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, cheat omnipotent. It's really one of my personal favorites.
every time I've played, it's awesome to see something different happen. And you were mentioning the pathfinding earlier, and my experience has been that if a brute wants to get somewhere, he's going to get there. And we keep talking about this garage encounter because it is sort of epic, but I've been on the other side of the map, like skirmishing, and all of a sudden I'll see like a freaking piece of metal go flying way up in the air and like all the way across the map. I guess like I had hit one of the brute's armor off. He's berserking. He's pissed. And just starts knocking everything in his way. There's metal flying everywhere. He climbs over a crate, and nothing's going to stop him from getting to me one way or the other.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's right.
I guess when you're a big hulking behemoth, pathfinding becomes easy because you can just knock crap out of your way if it's blocking you.
Never. It's never easy. Pathfinding is always hard, no matter what. But yes, I mean, like getting across the character of the brute as like this powerful thing that's going to like. Mercilessly smash anything out of its way. Yeah, it's been fun. Yeah, it's definitely been a fun process getting that all working and working.
Other thing that we may want to just touch on briefly because it has been noted in some of the magazines that have come out lately. One of the other sort of big new AI improvements in the game is a scarab. Now has real AI. It isn't just sort of walking down a path as a piece of geometry. Do you have to approach something like that differently with that kind of scale, or is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
How was that to work on?
Yeah, it was really fun, and you know, we did a lot of that stuff in the early prototyping. So like probably in the first year or so of Halo 3, we had the scarab pretty much done from the AI side. The scarab is a lot of fun. Yeah, he does have to behave differently because he's obviously not going to come like searching for you in the same way that you hide behind a barrel or something. He can't like, oh, let me pick a point next to you that will uncover you because he's just too freaking big. And we had to do like lots of other stuff just to deal with the scale, because the scale presents all kinds of obviously performance problems as well as
I've noticed that hanging out right underneath it seems to be a fairly safe strategy, and then every once in a while it maybe it's just in my head, but he tries to step on me.
Oh yeah, no, he'll do that
because he can't shoot directly below himself, but sure, he can just crush me with his foot.
Yeah, and ultimately he's also just going to try and again like get. I mean that is in fact
let you get to flank him. I mean he always tries to keep that gun on you, so you can't expose any weakness.
Yeah, but it is fun. You can try, but even like. Even hanging out underneath him is something you have to work at.
Because
he does know you're under
there.
He's constantly trying to
jockey for position.
Exactly. Yeah. And another big challenge with the scarab was all the guys running around on top of him.
Yeah.
That's not easy to have like an AI running on top of another AI and have it all work.
And what about like the 12 to 15 other dudes on your side that are around as well? In that single encounter, there's probably how many different things going on, like how many AI things happening.
I'm talking about on the storm.
Yeah, the one that.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful scene. Like all those scarab encounters are great because those are sort of like, let's take everything we have and just like throw it in there.
Do you guys ever have to go back and like turn down the AI because it's too smart? Because I remember one example we talked about a while ago is. Somebody was, I think it might have been Joe, was in that encounter fighting the scarab, kind of trying some different stuff. Next thing you know is the scarab is down. And we thought it was a bug. And we watched the film. It turns out the AI Marines just beat the shit out of it. And it's like, that's awesome for them, but for a player, it's not that. I don't even know what happened. I turn around, next thing I know, this big thing's destroyed, and my Marines are all like, move on.
There are some small ways in which we have to cheat and make it so that the Marines like don't cause as much damage or sort of aren't quite as accurate against the scarab and that kind of thing. Exactly. Precisely in order to try to get it to be the player who delivers the crushing blow.
Remember our early build for E3 when there was this obviously isn't what we're shipping now. It's already been remedied. But in the beginning of our E3 build for that section of Sierra 117, we'd be practicing it, and For a few iterations, the Arbiter would just tear off at full speed and kill everything. So it's like,
right.
By the time you demo, there's like one Covenant left.
There's one guy left.
The Arbiter is just up front, like tapping his foot, like, let's go.
Yeah, looking at his watch. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's pretty brutal.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, so that's, again, like, in a lot of ways, that's not even an AI problem. It's a design problem in that a lot of what the designers do and something like the, you know, in the encounter with the Scarab, in that particular one on the Storm, a lot of what Niles is doing in that particular case is managing who should be fighting who. Because what he's tried to do is basically like set up a couple layers of the combat so that you look up and you see the Hornets fighting the Banshees, and you look down and this group of grunts is fighting this group of Marines, and then you and your buddies in the Mongoose are fighting the Scarab. So the whole point is to try and get like this nice distributed action going, you know. So it's true, like, it doesn't feel right or particularly fun if everybody's like, oh, Scarab's the most important thing to kill, let's all kill the Scarab.
Hornets raining down missiles.
Like, yeah, Luke's exactly. Stealing all my killing blows in the metagame when we're doing co-op, for example.
Listen, yeah. What are you talking about? Yesterday when we played, you were like, I'm just going to leave you dead and get mad points. And then you did.
It's a proven tactic. And then what'd you do? Pause it and revert to the last save checkpoint?
Yeah, that's what happens when you're the party leader.
And I'm trying to file a bug. Like, meanwhile, I'm like typing up a bug in Raid that the game just mysteriously reset to the checkpoint.
That's right. Yeah, and some engineer spends 4 hours trying to figure out what happened.
Well, Luke won't fix.
Luke, yeah, that's right. Luke
I won't
Luke,
fix
Luke
it.
Luke copped to it, so I didn't actually file the bug.
I was
kind of baffled by what happened, but it's a proven tactic.
We're only playing with that thing from now on.
Nice.
So a lot of people always... I mean, the elites are really iconic in Halo,
mm-hmm.
and we get a lot of people talking about how they want to fight the elites. And fighting the brutes in Halo 2 was a completely different experience than fighting the brutes in Halo 3. What are the differences, you know, in terms of behavioral differences between fighting an elite and fighting a brute? Obviously, we have the dynamics of equipment, but what other sort of behavioral things have changed?
Between Halo 2 and Halo 3, you mean?
For the
brutes?
Yeah, for the brutes.
I heard the brutes were just bullet sponges in Halo 2.
That's what I heard. I think Chris Butcher said that.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
But then also, as far as the dynamics of fighting brutes versus fighting elites in Halo 2. I mean, in fighting elites in Halo in general.
Well, the one thing I'll say is that in Halo 2, the brutes were... They were a character that you only fought, in the last third of the game or quarter of the game or something like that. Yeah. And they were designed as such. You know, they were designed to be a very different kind of character from the elites to make it, you know, make it very obvious that they were a different experience fighting them. But they didn't necessarily receive the love and the depth that the elite combat model received. And, you know, when we approached Halo 3, we were like, well, look, I mean, the brutes are going to be the, you know, backbone character of the Covenant in this game. So we have to go back and, like, really think much more deeply about how they react in all these situations. Like, what is it that's, you know, how do you fight them, and how do we make that interesting and not make them just bullet sponges? So I know one of the earliest things that we talked about and Chris Butcher was very adamant on this point that the damage model for the brutes had to be different and interesting. And by damage model, I mean in Halo 2, you know, they have a certain amount of body health and you shoot them a lot and the body health depletes and they're dead. Whereas the elites of Halo 1 and Halo 2 have sort of the two healths. They have
shields,
the shield health and they have the body health. And there's the whole dynamic of get down their shield. And now you got to kill them right away, because if not, the shield comes back up and you've just wasted ammo and not achieved anything. And so we went back to that model and said, well, how do we, you know, add something like this to the brutes, but also make it different? And so we came up with the idea of sort of the non-replenishing armor. That's not quite true. The armor does replenish on the brutes, but very slowly. And so what you get is basically the ability to... Yeah, I bet you didn't know
I killed them
how
too fast
that?
And efficiently.
And they, well,
exactly.
The other thing is that the brutes have... I mean, they have measures at their disposal to aid the refueling of their armor. So they can accelerate that process as well, correct?
Say that again, sir.
You're being really cryptic. What?
Yeah, I know. I don't know if we've talked about it yet.
What are you getting at?
No, they can deploy equipment that'll accelerate their shield recharge.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
The regenerator that I mentioned a little while ago?
I don't think you mentioned it.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, well, I
we'll have to edit this part out because obviously that's a secret.
No, it's out there.
I don't know. I can't keep track of all of it.
I just read it in EGM the other day.
It's a tightrope, man. It's a freaking tightrope.
It is. But so they have ways of intelligently, you know, refreshing these the power armor.
Yeah. I mean, they have. I mean, that's kind of a. It's not part of the fundamental mechanic, of course, of how they receive and deal with damage. But yeah, I mean, it is a fun thing that we added on actually fairly late to the process to sort of make them more intelligent and make them more sort of self-sustaining and the rest of it. Yeah. No, I mean, the addition of equipment is just awesome. I mean, like the addition of like, I've said it before, like the more the AI has to do, like the more actions that they have available to them in any particular situation, the more interesting they are. And so the equipment's just a great addition to the sandbox in that way. They also, I mean, whatever, they also throw grenades, and they throw grenades a lot, you know, which the elites did not do. So, yeah, it's awesome.
That's probably about enough on AI for today.
Yeah, I'm sure Damian has bugs to fix.
Well,
bugs
it's never
fix,
enough.
Work to do.
Lunch to have.
Well, lunch.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's cool.
Beer to
Sketch
drink.
And I'll have lunch sometime today.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on, and you know, I'd like to think this was very interesting, and it may very well be higher rated than D. Miller's appearance. So we'll see what we can do in the last half of the show to put over the top for you.
You know, and if you want to set up like a wrestling match, like a mud wrestling match or something between me and D. Miller, that would also work too.
Well, you already sort of said that anything that's sort of wrong with AI in a mission is usually design related. So
that's absolutely true.
Yeah, absolutely true. Fully agree.
I'm staying out of this. I learned my lesson with the artists. We'll be right back after a quick break. And we're back from what was actually a real break. Normally, when we say we're taking a break, it's to kick out the special guest. But this time, Brian and I went and did things and stuff.
Work, yeah. Like yeah. Hours have passed.
It's yeah. Now hours have passed. It's late in the day. The adults have gone home.
Yeah. Now we have earlier it was too early in the day to use our normal tradition of frosty beverages while the podcast is in session, but I think it's officially that point in the day now where yep. We don't have to feel guilty, and so here we are.
Yeah, frosty o'clock.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll toast to that.
So you were talking a little bit at the end of our break about your text adventure game you're going to give us from your high school years.
I wish I still had it. I mean, I was not. You know, that was back when I maybe thought I would write AI for a Blockbuster game when I grew up, but you know, it was either that or the ASCII art also opened a bunch of doors for me. But that was honestly, that was I think we had Commodores back then, or it was really rudimentary, but it was create your own little text adventure with awesome ASCII like pop-up screens as the big reward for solving the game. So
wow.
Yeah, that just shows how far we've come as an industry.
And how far you've come.
I know.
I mean,
I maybe could have gotten a deal with Burger King back then, or, you know, we could have had a Slurpee, but, you know, I like to, I do it for the sake of making art. I wasn't really interested in promotion.
Speaking of promotion, you were out in New York last week.
I'm a promoting fool right now. Absolutely. And like we said before, I mean, Frank, as this very moment, is literally down under with Lars doing a lot of promotion as well.
Doing something.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of shrimps on the Barbie and stuff like that. But they're in Australia, so as glorious as that sounds, I think Frank literally spends more time in an airplane and airport than he ever will in Australia. So it isn't quite as awesome as it sounds. It's actually kind of grueling, and we've both done a lot of travel and had a lot more to go. But I was in the Big Apple last week. I happened to get there right in time for what ended up being the I guess the first time in 116 years, a tornado touched down right in the middle of the city and ravaged the Bronx area. So that was interesting. I think that threw a little wrinkle into our plans. I think all the transit for the following day was in chaos, and we had a lot of media that couldn't make it. But this was essentially an event Microsoft hosts to promote Xbox and all the holiday titles, and they invite a lot of different media outlets to come and check them out in hopes that they'll go. And when they start writing, you know, every magazine and sort of show does like a gift guide and things like that. And what people may not realize is that a lot of those things start right now, and they may not come out until October, November. So that was their purpose. And of course, we never send Halo 3 out and let anybody else touch our game but us. So I had to go and chaperone our build. And over the course of 2 days, I talked to a couple different reporters from a wide variety of outlets. But the cool part was, on Wednesday night, we had a little small cocktail party. And this was in the suite of a hotel on the Lower East Side, up on the 20th floor. It was like allegedly like a $5,000 a night suite. It's pretty amazing. Two stories. The entire thing was enclosed in glass, so you have a view of the entire city. It was actually a quite romantic location. Mm. But we had 8 different stations set up with like 42-inch 1080p monitors, Halo 3. I brought the build with me, and Microsoft just invited a bunch of people from the New York area that, you know, in the hopes that they're already Halo fans, and some of the ones that aren't maybe would come like it, and potentially Halo would somehow carry over into the work they do. So, for example, I believe we had some writers show up from The Late Show, The Daily Show, people like that. And I got to meet some people as well. I got to meet Andy Samberg and Jason Sudeikis, who are cast members on Saturday Night Live, and turns out they're huge, huge Halo fans. Jason, somebody that I had met back for a Halo 2 event, and it turns out that he still plays all the time.
Was he on SNL back then?
Was he what?
Was he on
I think he had just
then?
Started. Yeah. Honestly, though, I was watching him play, and at one point they were playing a bunch of split screens, so there was like 12 people total in this multiplayer match on Shrine, 4 teams of 3. And his team won, and he individually had more points than like any other team did, and had more points than the other two of the other teams combined. So the guy's a monster, and I'm like, wow, you're really good at this game, huh? Because sometimes people show up for free drinks or to get their picture taken, but they were like legitimate Halo players, and I kind of knew that was the case when he told me that he got way better at the game for playing so much SWAT in Halo 2. So he actually can talk the talk as well. So he's a SWAT guy, and who would have thunk it?
He sounds like meat for the hump day.
Hopefully that'll pan out. You know, I tried to do some networking there, and I extended the offer for those guys to, of course, be on our podcast, stop by the studio, and hopefully when the game comes out, we can hook up and play with them on Xbox Live. But they were cool. That was fun, just because they're actually real fans, and they weren't there just looking to promote themselves. They genuinely liked the game, so that was fun.
Anyone else interesting?
Actually, you know, there was I did spend, because of all the weather and travel issues, we had a light media day. A lot of the appointments just didn't show because of various issues. So, as fate would have it, I spent a large amount of time hanging out with, Cliffy B.
That's my boy.
Of Gears and Epic fame. He was there along with, a guy named Rod, who's a producer at Epic. Of course, they're showing off, Gears for PC. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time together in that suite hanging out, playing a lot of Halo together. I think Rod and I beat Savo Highway co-op numerous times over the course of those 2 days. At one point, I even used the film that the two and three of us generated to actually do a media demonstration. So I would like to give a big shout-out and a thanks to Cliffy and Rod for really helping me promote Halo 3. And for helping the media have a great Halo experience in New York.
That sounds like overall a really good and a fun event. And you got to go with your wife, so you had some fun, right? You
got one extra day out of it. So unlike Frank's crazy brutal trip, I made a point of having one extra day to myself, which was.
You went to, like, you were balling, right?
Well, you know, where'd you go? What are we gonna do? But so, you know, whatever. We were able to kind of squeeze in at Nobu, and you know, I mean, yeah, whatever. It's just some fancy seafood. But yeah, it was fun. We did the town up, but you know, I will say that at that event I was talking about at night, Cliffy was there too, and he was playing multiplayer and. He was actually doing pretty good. He was kicking some ass. It was funny. True story. There was a guy there. I don't know who he was, but he wasn't a gamer. And he asked me, and Cliff's sitting right next to me, why isn't this game third person like Gears? That would be so awesome. And, well,
is he Japanese?
It's Halo, not Gears. But yeah, Cliff was there to personally hear that. But he actually did a pretty good job. He did a personal demo and showed a guy how to play who was there from the New York Knicks. I don't really recall his name. I'm not a huge sports guy.
God,
I apologize.
He's like doing a job for you.
I know. I'm serious. We definitely owe Cliff like a free copy of Legendary Edition. I think he might have sold a few more for us over the last week.
Well, moving on.
Speaking of sports nuts.
oh, God.
I don't know if our listeners would be as shocked as me to find out this piece of information, but... the other day, true story, I was asking Luke if he wanted to go online when we got home and play some Halo 3 co-op together and, you know, test out and maybe play the Epsilon against some Microsoft people. And turns out he had plans. He was actually camping out in line.
I was not camping in line.
To get Madden.
No,
the,
I was. I
Madden
went out,
2008.
I went to get drinks with a friend of mine who was in town from Ziff. Covering Game Fest, and then after that was over, before I went, I pre-ordered Madden, and after that was over, I swung by the store at midnight, picked up my copy, and went home and played. And then last night when you want to play the Epsilon, I was like, you know, I've got this fantasy football draft, and then that draft fell through, and then you're playing Epsilon, and all I was doing was playing Madden all night.
Yeah, I noticed. I saw. So, I mean, I
you should get it.
There you go, folks. Luke is officially over Halo 3 and would prefer to play sports games now. So
that's a good spin. Great.
I never pegged you as a hardcore sports gamer. Now you're like wearing jerseys to work and you got like pennants hanging up over your desk now.
It's a big year for the Colts.
I mean, you've been here how many months and you already got a Hawks Forever tattoo on your on your bicep? Seriously, you might want to tone it down. We're not really a bunch of jocks in this building, so just, you know, we are gamers.
I don't want to stick out.
Stay true to your roots. Don't go down that path.
So, to recap a little bit of what appeared on the site last week, we finally showed the flamethrower and the fourth grenade we revealed. And there's been a lot of information about it now. I mean, you've probably read about it on BNet, and IGN showed it as well. And one of the things that I want to talk about was, do you remember when we were playing with the flame grenade months and months ago?
Yeah.
And on Guardian, the flame grenade was just, it was like a one-hit.
Insta-kill.
It was like throwing a rocket at someone.
It was.
And then I used it all the time. God, I miss those days.
Yeah, I remember that quite vividly, because that was at a point in time where I hadn't played in a little while. I didn't even know those grenades were added to the map. And I remember I really quickly learned that that's all we were doing was just throwing flowing firebombs at each other.
Yeah, and at the time, the flamethrower was on the map as well, and the flamethrower would undergo so many revisions that when you'd play the map, you'd wonder, like, oh, is this the version of the flamethrower that's awesome? Or is this the version of the flamethrower that's like, yeah, maybe I should go get something else, like a plasma pistol?
It's definitely, I still think it's awesome, but it's going to have limited uses, I think, depending on the maps. It's really hard to resist the urge to run over and pick it up because it looks awesome and the fire is really cool, but chances are that your opponents have battle rifles and carbines.
Or an assault rifle.
And you'll never get close enough to burn them and they'll just kill you. So, it's going to be an awesome, like, defensive weapon if you're going to try to guard your flag or something like that. I could see that working out pretty well.
Throw up a bubble shield and cower in it with a flamethrower. Could be an interesting technique.
Fill it up with fiery death. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. A little frosty burp there.
Yeah, slow it down over there, cowboy.
So to move on real quick, we've got some questions from the readers. And these all came either through the BungieNet boards or About 1,000 of them I get every day to my box, which I do try to read all of them.
To your personal box?
To like the my BNet account. I even get positive feedback there, which I know they're not supposed to send.
Wow, cool. I haven't seen any positive feedback yet.
So the first question is, can you guys discuss the availability of Halo 3 at launch? How hard will each of the editions be to find on launch day or the midnight openings? And how many copies of the editions should be at retailers? The last question is going to vary by all kinds of factors. It's going to vary by the size of the area you live in, the size of your retailer.
Well, I mean, in some degree, all three of those questions are going to be dependent on individual retailers, right? I mean, I don't know how many any given store plans to stock, much less are they going to open at midnight? How many are they going to offer at midnight? I will say I don't think there's going to be any problem finding the game itself at midnight on launch day or the following day. My understanding is Microsoft's going to push it as hard as they can and get a lot of copies out there. So I don't think it's going to be a case where they're all gone. What I do think you will find just logically is Legendary is going to be the rarest and least likely to come by. Followed by limited edition, and then of course I think the regular version of the game will be out there in a pretty wide range. Last I heard, legendaries were actually getting snapped up pretty quickly on pre-orders and online. If that is something that interests you, I would recommend pre-ordering that soon. I think some retailers have even indicated they're about to stop taking pre-orders, or they already have. I think that's a retailer by retailer decision, and it's up to some stuff that they've got going on. We don't have any insight into who's doing what or who has how many allotments. It actually is limited though, and it is being sold in a couple different parts of the world. Last I heard from my colleagues over there, the people that I talked to in the marketing side of Microsoft, they did expect the vast majority of legendaries to all be gone by the first or second day, strictly through pre-orders and online as well. So chances of like walking into Target on the 25th and finding legendary, I think would be extremely, extremely slim, just based on they're a little bit rare and they're just big, bulky, expensive items that a lot of retail shops are going to carry personally.
Yeah, it takes up a lot of shelf space, so it's going to be difficult to clear room for it.
Yep. I do think limited will be a little easier to come by, and then the regular game as well. So, I mean, your best bet, honestly, is just to order the flavor that you like as soon as possible, and you'll be all set.
The next question, this is totally authentic. I didn't alter this at all. Will the super awesome, hilariously entertaining, and Grammy Award-winning Bungie podcast continue after the Halo 3 launch?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to go anywhere, right? They're going to continue to be regular, and there's a bunch more stuff that we haven't even got to goof around with yet, as far as, like, we haven't even started to ban dudes from Xbox Live.
I don't think we'll have any shortage of stuff. As long as people keep listening and want it, we're going to keep doing it, because I think we're starting to get better at it, and it's fun for us.
What's the weapon you enjoy using most in Halo 3?
The weapon I personally enjoy using most? Oh, that's a good question. You know, lately, it's a lame answer. It seems like it's in flux for me. It varies a lot. I assume maybe we're talking about multiplayer in this case, probably, for context. Sometimes I really love using, like, a single mauler. The mauler melee combo is just ridiculous running around a map like Guardian that plays similar to Lockout. It's just a 1-2 punch. Mauler has a really awesome sound and feel to it, followed by a melee attack, instant kill. I don't know. Other times the hammer's awesome. The one hit death fire bombs were fun for a while they lasted.
Yeah. I think it's probably still the sniper rifle for me. It's still like when I was looking at my stats on the test version of BNet, and the sniper rifle is still the weapon I've recorded the most kills with since I've been here.
So we're tracking what weapon you use the most on BNet. That's cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting little feature.
Huh. I don't know. For me, I mean, I'm lethal with every element of the Halo golden tripod.
You can take a plasma pistol and do work.
That's true. I can.
Another guy asks, WTF is Epsilon? Will members of the Friends and Family Beta receive an invite for Halo 3 Epsilon? Epsilon's what people have been seeing on some members' gamer tags on Xbox Live. And it is at the final phase of internal testing?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I guess it comes after Delta, and essentially, technically speaking, the public beta was really our Delta in the sense that we had already done a couple iterations prior to that. So this is just the next step in that. It's internal only, and I'm afraid we have no plans to include anybody outside of Microsoft. So as much as we love our friends and family and everybody in the community, there are no plans to open the Epsilon test up. Essentially, this is our last chance to take one last look at networking, matchmaking. Now that we have co-op in the game in a solid way, the Epsilon does include one campaign mission, so people are playing co-op together, and it's just one last way to make sure that things are in really good shape before we hand off the discs.
The next question is, I was wondering about Halo 3 save games that I played on the beta. Will those still be here when we start up Halo 3, the real game? And the answer to that is your save films from the beta are invalid. But as I found out this week as I was screwing around on my my 360 hard drive, those files still persist. They just won't be played back. So you should probably go through if you saved a bunch of films and just delete them anyway. Mm. It's not going to affect your Halo 3 experience adversarially. You just want to get them off there because they're taking up some space.
Honestly, as memorable and fun as the beta was, I think once people see how much better the game is now, how far it's come, and the fact that the save films now allow you to move your camera and detach it and fly anywhere you want, I don't think you're going to find those old films to be very interesting anymore, personally.
Next question is, for the past week, I've been sending friends requests. Can you please add me? I will pay you $13 to add me. No, I thank you for attempting to be welcomed into the friends list, my friends list on Xbox Live. But the space is kind of limited, and I'm pretty close to full. And I pretty much only have people on my friends list who I know in real life. So I thank you, and hopefully we'll cross paths in matchmaking.
It's true. It's nothing personal.
Yeah, it's just a matter of I gotta have the dudes on there that I know from back in the day,
or in Frank's case, the chicks.
Yeah, tons of girls.
Yeah.
Will the gravity hammer have a battery that depletes, or will it be like the sword in Halo 2 multiplayer? Well, we haven't really talked about this before, but one of the things that surfaced in EGM way, way back in October was that the energy sword was going to have a battery, and as a close quarters melee weapon, a weapon that doesn't deplete could potentially be overpowering. So in an effort to balance the game, I mean, it seems like a pretty safe assumption.
Yeah, I would say so.
Is Frankie really colorblind, or was he joking?
As far as I know, he really, truly is.
He's absolutely colorblind.
Based on like some of the outfits he wears to work.
Did you see him in the Australia video?
Yeah.
Where he was wearing like a My Chemical Romance hoodie.
Yeah, I was actually with him when he bought that hoodie.
At Hot Topic?
I didn't buy it at Hot Topic. We were down at E3, he bought that, back when there was a memo that's back when it said that all game developers needed to wear hoodies. Actually, remember I told you guys that during the pre-briefing rehearsal stuff, there was like a stylist, like a slide, one of the slides in the briefing deck talked about attire, and it was like
hip jeans.
People at this level need to wear like blazers and like hip suits, and then developers was like dark jeans and hoodies. And
it was like a zip hoodie though, right?
I think practically speaking, I remember we were down there, it was kind of chilly at night, so Frank didn't bring a jacket at all, so he went out and bought that one. But yes, I think he is legitimately truly colorblind.
He is, and actually everyone who
works... He's red-green colorblind.
Everyone who works up at our pod, Joe Staten, Rob McLeese, myself, and Frank are all colorblind.
Huh.
I know.
Well, we like to sometimes play red versus green just to screw with Frank. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, I actually don't play those games. I quit. Go play campaign alone. Well, I have to unlock...
You're going long?
Going deep. Well, I have to unlock...
Can you do end zone dances in Madden now?
I don't know. I do them at my house.
I saw you doing the... What's the dirty bird up here the other day?
It was the icky shuffle.
Okay.
Well, I have to unlock different armor permutations before I can see other players wearing them in multiplayer.
Interesting twist on that question.
Yeah. You thought we were going one way, and then our endearing user switched it.
Yeah, like a cutback.
Yeah.
That was like a play fake.
So
my guess is no.
No, you don't have to
unlock
them.
What would they be? Just big blank blobs running around that you couldn't, it just says like censored or confidential all over it, or
that's a kind of a cool idea. Can we squeeze that in?
I think it's the ultimate tease to see your friends wearing awesome armor that you haven't actually acquired yet.
Yeah, I wonder. When you fellas take a build home to play, what are the rules on where you can play it, who's allowed to see it, and the possibility of information being leaked ever used as an excuse to... force people to leave the room so you have the TV to yourself?
I mean, we've been playing the game in a debug state for a couple of years now, so I mean, we don't have any risk of leaks here internally. We're all professionals about this, and it's our own game. We don't want it leaking in an unfinished state either. For me personally, I can usually accommodate about 15 people in my basement, and I usually like post a notice on my blog like the night before, sort of open a line. I usually fetch about $100 a ticket and fill it up with local kids. We play for a couple hours, and then I kick them out.
We should really start to invite the blogs to those. Like, get the bloggers down, come in, they can live blog you playing Halo 3.
And dying? Yeah, I think I've tried that before.
The last question for this week is, what weapon has seen the biggest change from the beta? I actually know the answer to this question.
Oh, you do, huh?
I do, but I wanted to see if you thought...
Biggest change from the beta?
Like, so what weapon that appeared in the beta has changed the most to the retail game?
Well, the weapon in the beta that jumped out to me the most immediately as potentially being a little bit too powerful and deadly in the beta was the carbine. Whether or not it's changed significantly, I'm not sure, but it doesn't seem to be the all-ending...
death-dealing piece of
like
awesome that it was.
Infinite range, fast-firing, deep clip, two-headshot kills. It feels like it's been toned down and balanced a little bit differently, in my opinion.
Correct.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the carbines now. Yeah, you didn't even have to play on the hardcore team to figure that out.
I know, yeah.
That's the weapon that's changed the most.
Huh, awesome.
Well, with that, that's all the
questions
for this
week. That's all we got, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know it's not a normal show without Frank, and who knows who's going to be on the show next week. We're all going our separate ways yet again. But as always, if you have feedback, we'd love to hear it. Great feedback. Send it to myself or Frank. All your complaints and issues can go directly to Luke, either on Xbox Live to his to his account, or, of course, you can reach us through Bungie.net as well.
And you can get the podcast both from Bungie.net, or if you haven't yet, you should subscribe to it via the iTunes Music Store, because it's there now with all the correct art and everything.
And tell your friends.
All of your friends.
We can't achieve world domination, but we can at least conquer the iTunes podcast chart.
We'll be back.
Thanks.
Bungie Studios podcast is mixed and mastered by Steve Lopez, produced by Tom Giaconda and Chris Gossett, and hosted by Brian Gerard, Frank O'Connor, Luke Smith, and Bungie Studios.